Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're actually talking CETA, but you won't think we're talking CETA because we're joined by Lynn Boylan, Senator Lynn Boylan of Sinn Féin, and also candidate of Dublin Bay South. So we will get to that as well. But Lynn, it's in the papers. You have also filed you're taking action against the Irish state in relation to CETA and the free trade deal that we have on this podcast spoken about for months and months and months. The Green Party's Patrick Costello also has a case that is pending, waiting on a date. The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has written an ode to CETA in the Irish Times as recently as a few weeks ago about how it's a wonderful thing. And Lynn, you might want to give us, if you don't mind, I know climate was even something that you worked on a lot when you were in the European Parliament and in your previous life outside of politics. You have a lot of concerns around CETA as well. In terms of the action you're taking, do you want to just tell listeners why, what it is, and what your hopes are?
Yes, yeah, so I suppose. Do you want me to start with just, I suppose, CETA itself? Like, I suppose is that what you want?
Yeah, go. Well, I mean, CETA for every, like, it's the free trade agreement between, it's a mixed agreement between the EU and Canada, which is almost 80% plus implemented at this stage. Most of the trade stuff is done.
Yeah, no, exactly. And some of the biggest concerns that I had as an MEP, and I think a lot of people who are on the left have, or just even anybody who's interested in public health, workers' rights, the environment had, was around the investor chapter of CETA, which sets up private courts for corporations to sue states if they don't like the policy that state's making. And I suppose these courts have been used in lots of international agreements, but Ireland has only really signed up to one, and it's a very narrow scope, which is the Energy Charter Treaty. And most people don't know that we've signed up to that. So we can maybe talk about that in a little while as well. But that, like, that's the big concern, is that why should multinational corporations have a private court so they can bypass the national courts? Unlike a citizen who wants to take a case would have to go through the whole court process, and even then exhaust all of those before you could take a case, say, to the European Court of Human Rights. Corporations bypass everything, go in the back door to a private court, and a private court that gives you a 5%, five times a better chance of winning. So the success rate for corporations in these courts is 28.7%. In a national court, the European Court of Justice is about 4.3%. So I think one academic put it very well in saying that it's like if you're playing a football match and playing home or away, you know. If you're going to the investor courts for the multinational corporations, you're playing at home. And I suppose, as you said, Leo Varadkar wrote an ode to CETA in the Irish Times. He literally didn't make one reference to this chapter. You know, he made no mention. He deflected from the fact that the trade bit is happening. The investor chapter, the most controversial bit, was the bit he didn't mention. But also, it's just, again, Fine Gael, you know, vested interests come first over citizens. You know what I mean? It's just another outworking of what we see with Fine Gael governments. You know, you've got your vulture funds, your cuckoo funds, and now you have an investor court, and, you know, and there is scope for those funds to sue Ireland if we ratify CETA, if we try to change housing policy, and particularly around the rental sector. So I suppose from that point of view, when I saw in December, now as a senator, you know, that was back in the as an MEP, I had concerns. But then when they tried to rush through the debate or the ratification process with a 55-minute debate, myself and Attracting Evrin mobilised. And no better woman than Attracting Evrin to mobilise and organise on a Friday evening. About 50 people, which I think you were at as well.
Yeah.
I thought I was coming into a quiet meeting with a glass of wine to strategize. But no, look, that was very effective. It managed to set the pause button on it. But in January then, myself and Attracta got talking, and she had been discussing this with a barrister who has same concerns as ourselves around the investor courts, but also the constitutionality of it. And that's how they approached me in January and said, would I consider taking the case? And we initiated the proceedings then in March. So we put the government on notice in March, gave them time to respond. And then in the interim, Patrick Costello started his case. But we're now looking at the possibility that the two cases will be run in parallel.
Just going to interrupt the podcast because, well, we have to. It's been, obviously, we're coming up on over 570 episodes of the Echo Chamber, and that's without the hundreds and hundreds of other podcasts that we produce on the Tortoise Shack. And it's become a huge industry in terms of the amount of work, effort, time, and opportunity cost that goes into it. And thousands of you are listening, like literally into the tens of thousands on a daily basis. Some days we've more, some days we've less, but it's in the thousands. And not many of you are actually putting your hands in your pocket and supporting us.
And it's going to lead to the situation, Tony, and we've discussed this, where we're just going to have to put it all behind a paywall. And if we do that, you won't hear these messages, because only people who pay for it will hear this.
I won't have to do these appeals, but I will say, here's the thing. I don't want to do that. But if you can afford to pay, and you're listening, you can afford to chip in and think on the basis that you're paying for someone who can't pay. And maybe that you doing that is paying it forward, that we can keep the thing bloody out there. But I don't want to do it, Martin. I just don't.
Yeah, and I know you don't want to. And I'm of it. Yeah, we've discussed, as Tony said, we've discussed this high and low. And I'm at the stage of saying, look, if we can't get more patrons by giving it out free, what we need to do is just put it all behind a paywall, and it's all for patrons. But we'd love to keep giving them out to everybody, because they're important conversations we're having, Tony.
Yeah, I understand. But I will cross that Rubicon when we get to it, I suppose. But in the meantime, if you're listening, if you're enjoying what's been produced on a daily basis, hours of content on a daily basis and conversations you don't get elsewhere, actually happens is you get months after we do them. But, you know, that's a story for their own talent scouts. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It means no ads. It means no sponsors. And it means actually you don't have to listen to these appeals, because the podcasts that go out there don't include these appeals. It just goes straight on through and you're not interrupted. Last again, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thanks a lot. Then in terms of the, okay, we people who, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably well familiar with the idea of these investor courts, the problems that they create in a parallel court system. You may also be aware that other countries that tie it into them in certain aspects are now trying to unwind them and get out of many of these deals, because they are considered advantageous for the likes of the vulture funds, the REITs, all of these private companies, private equity, I should say. And it's also important to note that one of the reasons it's said that the bills that were done to clip the wings of vulture funds and buying homes and all were so limited is because this would have meant we would be sued if we said to these REITs, you can't make profits by continuing to buy these apartments in Dublin. They could say you're interfering with how we do it in this investor mechanism. So we're almost future proofing their idea that they can do this for the next 25 years. You're saying it's going to be wrapped into possibly run concurrently with Patrick Costello's case itself. What are you hoping? You know, I mean, what is your ambition for it, for the case itself? What does success look like?
Yeah, well, I suppose success is not having CETA ratified, or at least having a referendum on whether or not we should ratify CETA. Do you mean around the constitutionality of it and putting that then to the public and saying, do you want a private corporate court? So that's the ultimate aim, is that this is a decision that should be taken by the people of Ireland. That'll have to be tested in the courts. I know Patrick, I think, has similar arguments on some cases, and I think there's some differences around it. But I suppose what we're saying about the reason for, I suppose, we're not objecting to running parallel is that if anyone was watching the European Affairs Committee when Leo Varadkar appeared before us, he made reference to individuals who are taking the case against CETA. And Patrick Costello wasn't in attendance, but he knew I was, because he made reference to me before the meeting started when we were in private session. He said, oh, I see Lynn is here. And then in his contribution said that, you know, about the fees, and that they would hope that anybody taking a case would contribute to the costs of that case, and that, you know, these are very costly and money has to come out of public services.
And he knew at this stage that you had filed.
Absolutely, yeah. So nobody else knew. But so the point that he made reference to me being at the meeting, do you know what I mean, before we went into public session and then made that point, I thought was very telling.
There's a huge public, I mean, there's a glaringly huge public interest in seeing this case. So, I mean, the idea that you'd carry costs on a case which is clearly of public interest, clearly. I mean, that's a notion, really, isn't it? That is some kind of notion to think that if you do something in the public interest, you should take it out of your back pocket. I mean, take it out of your back pocket to prove that the government is acting unconstitutionally. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's something that's, look, it's prevalent in Ireland. It's so expensive for people to go to court and to take, especially to take on the state. And then when you hear of what goes on behind the scenes to try and undermine individuals when they are taking those cases. So there's the financial risk, but there's also, I suppose, the personal risk as well as to what they're going to try and dig up. So, like, that's a real, that has a chilling effect on people taking the case. So I suppose that's why you often see, I suppose, people with a higher profile who have to do it, you know, and have to be able to take that risk. And it isn't, because it is in the public interest. But the irony of, I suppose, the way he sort of couched just the language, I'll be careful that I don't say anything libelous, but the way in which he made that reference around the costs and the money having to come from the taxpayer when you're actually trying to defend the public interest, but at the same time that this is actually a case about setting up private courts for multinational corporations that the state will then have to go and defend on a per diem rate, which is far more costly than going through the national courts. So yeah, it was an interesting eye opener anyway from him.
I'm going to disagree with you. I would say he's been very upfront. I mean, I referenced several times, I was on the Zoom webinar when he told the Vulture Funds and the REITs, stick with us. He said it to them. We're Ireland is going to be bouncing back, and stick with us. These are the people who he was talking to, and in my opinion, too often he governs for them. You know, we see it today where he made a comment about the fact that, sure, look, you know, don't worry about the property prices. They're not as bad as they were just before the last global financial crisis. I do want to broaden it out. We spoke to you only a few weeks ago, and there was rumors that you were going to be the candidate in Dublin Bay South, but you are now candidate Dublin Bay South. How has it been since you were ratified and since it all kicked off?
It's lovely to be in a summer campaign. We've had way too many winter campaigns. So, like, it's much easier to meet people and get out and about. But it's been really, really interesting to talk to people, because it, and I'm not just saying this, it is housing. In fact, last night we were in Kimmage and a young couple pulled up in their car and said, we didn't realise that there was an election going on, but we want to talk to you. We want to talk about housing. And I was like, well, you've come to the right person. So it's coming up. Like, the second person we met last night was, how do I get my 28-year-old son out of the house? Like, do you know what I mean? So, and this is an area that wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be Sinn Féin heartland, but people.
No, this is like, I want to be clear.
But
like,
the whole constituency, yeah.
Yeah, but you've seen the polls, you've seen the analytics. It's a Fine Gael seat that you're running for. I mean, you are in a constituency that the ABC one Fine Gael voter is more prevalent. Like, it's not typical of the Irish. Like, I remember, and with no offense to Jennifer Bray, but she said this would be a good
bellwether. Yeah.
Bellwether for, and I thought, no, if you're going to pick any constituency, it's not this one. Some of the more transient people who are renting in the areas, they may be registered to vote in Cork or Limerick or you know, wherever that is. So you are fighting an uphill battle here, Lynn.
I know it's a David and Goliath battle without a doubt. But one of the things we've pointed out is that, yeah, 50% of the, well, almost 50% of the households in Dublin Bay South are renters. And we have made a particular appeal to people who, as you said, might have had their vote back in Cork or Monaghan or Donegal or whatever. And we're saying, look, you're eligible to register in Dublin City Council if you really want to send the message. So you can still do that. You can still register online. There's a short window of opportunity, and we are encouraging people to do that. But I mean, look, nobody's underestimating. It is a big battle, but no, the response has been very positive in the areas we've been. So that's good.
You've got a great reception on the doors.
I know. We usually say, God, freezing night, warm reception. Can't even say that now.
In terms of the wider politics, though, you've seen recently all the opinion polls show Sinn Féin on the up, the highest that they've ever had in the Irish Times this morning. And over the weekend, they put some clear blue water between yourselves and Fine Gael for the first time. Does it feel like the momentum with the party, like it must be energizing? There must be feeling like there is. And is it just housing?
Well, I think that there's a number of things. So housing, absolutely. The people trust us on the housing issue, and the fact that we have put forward sort of credible proposals on every sort of facet of housing. And I won't big up Owen O'Brien anymore on that. But like there is a big body of work that's been done on housing, and I think people respect that. But there's also a feeling out there of that the other parties have had their chance. And if you're going to keep putting in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, then you're going to keep getting the same thing coming out of there. Do you know what I mean? So there is that feeling, especially among younger voters, but even going up to sort of the 30s and 40s, people are going, yeah, no, do you know what? Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they've had their chance. So, yeah, I think there's a mix of all of that. And look, we have a bigger team. So more people, more spokespeople, more in the front line.
There's no noises from Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael that they're actually going to address it. I mean, I think that's what's driving people away from them, is that they don't have a plan.
It's tinkering. It's they just cannot get beyond the fact that we can just tinker around and that somehow the market is going to figure this out, but we'll just, tinker this bit or just move that bit. And yeah, there's like... I was saying it to somebody else I was talking to the other day. It's like you need to have that fundamental mind shift, especially on housing, but on other issues as well, whether it's, a publicly funded health system or childcare or anything. It's that you have to move away from the market isn't going to fix this. And COVID, if that didn't open your eyes to the need for the state to get involved in things, then, nothing is going to do that. So I don't think they're capable of it. I think you can say with Fine Gael, look, that when they talk about us having an ideology, Fine Gael has an ideology, and that is very much a neoliberal Marxist-led ideology. Fianna Fáil, I just think, are out of ideas. They just don't have the ideas.
Searching for an identity in many ways. But I think, yeah, okay, we can. But again, here's the put back to Sinn Féin in general would be, we actually don't really know until you get into parallel. Campaign in one way, and we need to see that tested. Absolutely needs to see that tested. So I will reserve judgment until I see Owen O'Brien giving me a free house. But no, sorry,
I'll throw a curveball at you, Lynn. Both recent polls, going on the numbers, and just going on the numbers. I'm not talking ideology. That's a Sinn Féin Fianna Fáil coalition. On both sets of numbers. I mean, that's where they're sitting right now. And politics is all about numbers. It's all about numbers. And Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil could form a majority government, which is, it's there in the numbers. Do you think there's a prospect of I suppose, heal the split that's there for over 100 years?
I think, though, like the beauty of Irish politics is the transfer system. Do you know what I mean? And that idea that you can then transfer down and transfer left. And it's something that we're getting better at in Ireland in that message, do you know what I mean? And the left coming together. And I said it after I lost my seat, the left needs to work better. I said it last night on the Tonight Show that Ivana Bacha couldn't resist having a swipe, and you're going, no, this is the right. If you transfer left, don't give transfers to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and you reduce the numbers that they have, and then you maximize the potential for a left-led government. Do you mean? And that's what you have to focus on. You have to try and maximize the opportunity for that.
We worked tirelessly in the last election to just put the idea of vote left, transfer left out there. We said it across the platforms, but at the same time, you have to campaign on your own. You have to campaign like we expect to speak to the candidates from other parties soon, and they will all do that. But I do think it's no harm for platforms for us to encourage people to vote left, transfer left, and make sure that you don't have those votes going that direction. I'm just conscious of time as well, but I'd love to ask you the comments from the Taoiseach about United Ireland in his life. I broadly welcomed them, even if I thought they were kind of contradicted by his. No, Martin, you have to take him at his word, but it goes against everything he's said in terms of politically. You know, his response for a number of years while he was Taoiseach was to say, if you said it's raining outside, he'd say, yeah, but it's worse in the north. And you know, but so this mindset, it is a historic move from the leader of Fine Gael. Has it been accepted like that in Sinn Féin?
I think so. Look, after I lost my seat, I did a podcast, an online one with, I think, Dion Fanning for Joe.ie at the time. And I said that United Ireland won't be delivered by Sinn Féin. It just won't. It'll need a broad society, cross-party political movement that will bring that shift. No different to repeal, that you have people who have campaigned for repeal for decades and are probably sitting back going like, oh, Jesus, and then everybody jumped on at the last minute. I mean, and it's no different with United Ireland. So Sinn Féin, yes, we're a United Ireland party and that has been our thing since the foundation, but you're not going to deliver it on our own. So it has to be other political parties coming on board. It has to be civic society. And there's really great organisations out there that are doing the civic society bit. So yeah, like we welcome the fact that Leo Varadkar is talking about a United Ireland. Do you know what I mean? That means that the tide, as we've been saying, has shifted completely on this question. And you'd just be naive to bury your head in the sand and hope that it just goes away. So I think it's great.
Do you reckon that there's going to be some sort of push to have a United Ireland or the vote if there is a change of administration? I mean, that's the big prize, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, whenever a referendum is called, it's going to have to be, you know, given a good time lead in as well. So, I mean, I always look at the Scottish referendum, and while they didn't win, it demonstrated how one under the 16 year olds can vote. You know what I mean, and deserve to have the right to vote, but equally that you can have a conversation about not just, I suppose, the nuts and bolts of, in their case, the sovereignty and breaking away from the union, in their case, you know, reuniting, but that you could have a really good conversation about what society looks like. And it's not just bolting on the six counties, it's that what would a United Ireland look like? And I think that's the model that I would like to see us go down. Do you mean, and those sort of community centre based meetings, and if you just look at Scotland now and the SNP, look at they're growing in strength all the time, but it's because they're I suppose the outworkings of, okay, we haven't got our independence yet, but we have discussed what type of society we would like, and the SNP are trying to implement that as much as possible with the national question and holding a second referendum. So I think it's really important that you follow that model and obviously not follow the Brexit omni-shambles model.
Yeah, no, I think actually I'm heartened to hear you outline it like that, because we spoke to Sam McElwain, who's very much a unionist socialist and progressive, but and a Democrat, but also feels very British. You know, and says, as far as he's concerned, his feet sit on British soil when he stands up in the morning. And, you know, so it's about making inroads into that. And we talk about the shared island. We spoke to Colin Harvey, who was brilliant at this and like much more able to put this together. And we do continue to cover it. If I could move on, though, you did mention at the outset the energy charter. Ireland has a mixed bag when it comes to this. Do you want to just give us a quick synopsis or just give us the idiot's guide to where we are and what the status is?
Yeah, the Energy Charter Treaty is something as was nobody really knows about. It was the best, one of the best kept secrets. I believe it was under Bertie Ahern's tenure. But it is a I came kind of out of the Cold War era, and it was supposed to be about energy security. But what was interesting about it was that it came with an investor chapter. And it really interesting is that it was rushed through the Dáil without debate in pretty much a similar fashion to which they tried to do with CETA. So we are signed up to investor chapter under the Energy Charter Treaty. How it's come into, I suppose, the public domain more now is because European countries are being sued on a very regular basis by fossil fuel companies because they're trying to obviously take climate action. So if you take the case of, I think the Netherlands are being sued for 1.4 billion by a coal company because they're trying to phase out the use of coal burning. I think the nuclear plant, when Germany decided to phase out nuclear energy, they were sued under the Energy Charter Treaty as well. But the problem, I suppose, for Ireland, because people have said, or I think, again, Leo Varadkar said, oh, but should the Energy Charter Treaty, you know, wasn't found to be unconstitutional, so therefore CETA has to be. And you're like, no, it's never tested. Mm. And, you know, until you test something, then you don't know. Do you know what I mean? And it really did go in under the radar. And not excusing the fact that there wasn't a Dáil debate, the number of cases being taken under this treaty now and in investment chapters and other trade treaties has just ramped up in the last 20 years.
Can I come in on one, just because it always comes back? It always strikes me as crazy that we talked. There's a famous one in India where they were building hydroelectric dams, and I think it was Enron were behind a lot of it. And Enron, as people might know, was one of the companies that basically helped screw the world and went kaput. But Enron are still being paid in some way, shape, or form, whether it's Enron subsidiary or whatever it is, for the next 50 years by the Indian government, because they managed to say, under this, we had this deal with you to maintain this hydro stuff. And they're still paying it because these bloody contracts that they put themselves into and gave the investor that growth model where they guarantee these returns. We have to tread a lot more carefully and a lot more sensibly, because foreign capital is a wash in Dublin as it is. We don't need it to dominate our energy.
Lynn, the other point in the Energy Charter Treaty, which I think is interesting from an Irish perspective, is the programme for government included a ban on the importation of fracked gas. And now the Minister Ryan, now he's in government, has said that, well, we looked at it and it's actually legally complicated. And so what we've done is we've issued a government statement on policy, but not go as far as a legal ban, because the Attorney General said it wouldn't be in compliance with EU law. Now, that's bull, because I have it in black and white from the research services of the EU saying, no, it's up to a member state to decide what energy mix it wants. And NUIG as well, under the wonderful Maeve O'Rourke, had two students do an legal opinion which said we could ban LNG. So I've asked the question, and I've asked the Climate Action Committee to look at this. Was the Energy Charter Treaty in the back of the mind of the Attorney General when they said, yeah, of course you can ban the importation of fracked gas? Nobody's saying you can't do that, but are you prepared to pay the costs? Because let's think of a company who were told, they've invested in all of the planning and all of the application. They were told it was by Fine Gael, no, you're being put in a PCI list. We actually want you to get EU funding. And then there's a change of government. And suddenly in the programme for government, you're told, no, we're going to ban it. I think they'd have a fairly strong case under the ECT. Oh,
they would absolutely, and that is actually one of the. We're saying the quiet part out loud here, if you know what I mean. When you look at it, can I ask what it's again? I will come back to the election, but I want to ask one question. The climate bill passed last night. It was something that I know yourself and several senators had a lot of concerns about. One of the consensus. There's two schools of thought out there. This is a historic moment. It's great. The climate bill has passed. And I've seen many former Greens who left this disillusion saying the fact that it was got cross-party support from so many shows that it doesn't upset the status quo at all. Which camp do you sit in?
I think it's definitely far better than the first draft that Eamon Ryan brought to us in, I think, back in October. Like, I was always kind of shocked by the fact that this was supposed to be the whole rationale for going into government. Well, other stuff, but this was a linchpin of the Greens going in. I would have thought they would have had a ready-made climate bill. But, you know, the draft was really poor. So this is a significant improvement. But it was really disappointing that they wouldn't accept any amendments you know, and on like whatever about the hardliners, you know, of the rural independence and that, I think there was like the opposition have worked really constructively on this bill. We got it improved at committee. We brought forward amendments like on just transition around the legal ambiguity on things, and you were just knocked back. So I think that is really disappointing. But I don't think you could stand over voting against, because we need it. We need to start doing our bit as a country on climate action. And at least this now, I suppose, compels the government to act, and that there's no more kicking the can down the road, and no more, you know, kind of throwing our hands up in the air every time we don't miss a target. We're going to have to now start reaching targets. But the just transition part is key. And they're promising us that there's going to be a just transition bill. Let's see. But I do think it was deeply concerning that it did only get a passing mention in the bill. Because, look, climate action has to happen, but you've got to bring people on that journey with you. And
well, it was an improvement on their original. The original was just a good copy and paste of what Fine Gael had done in the
worse.
Had proposed, you know. So it is somewhat of an improvement, but, you know, it's still a long way off the mark.
Yeah, it is. But as I said, it's better than not having it. And I think that's the approach that was taken by, and you can see, like, by the numbers who voted, you know, that we need this, and we need to start the action now. We can't delay it any longer. It'll come back to the Seanad. We'll try again. We'll fight the good fight to get those amendments passed. But I suppose the intention is that they're not accepting any. But I think it is a good day that we have a climate bill. But yeah, as you said, it could have been much better, and the process could have been more accommodating.
It's funny when we've spoke to John Schwartz of The Intercept and Seamus Malksali, who's based in the US but covers a lot of Middle East for us, and they both can't get over the fact that Joe Biden has been more radical in what he's done. And actually, Eric Lonergan pointed out, the economist and hedge fund manager, that Joe Biden's been more ambitious when it comes to these sort of things than anyone in the EU. And Ireland, unfortunately, is showing up there again. Oh, do you want to finish with the by-election? Just looking at it. So there's yourself, Bridget Purcell, Peter Dooley, Claire Byrne, Sarah Durkin, Ivana Bacic, Deirdre Conroy, James Gagan, Manix Flynn, and then a couple of other people who I won't say their names on this podcast. Do you think you can win? And what's your last kind of, if you can, how do you win?
I really do believe we can win. And like, it's about mobilizing both Sinn Féin core voters, and then people who are just, I suppose, fed up with the status quo. And I suppose the argument I'm making with people is, who do you think is the best opportunity? Who do you think will wipe the smile off the government's face most by taking that seat? Do you know what I mean? And will send the strongest message. And I think, like, there's great candidates in the field, but this is a by-election. It's not a general election. This is about, I suppose, that idea of a referendum on government. And I suppose, how do you send that strongest possible message that they need to start sitting up and listening, and I suppose governing for people and not for business? So that's, I suppose, the message that we're taking out there. But it can be done. It'll be done if our voters come out, if people who are renters come out, and if people who vote for a different candidate transfer to us. We will absolutely depend on those transfers. So as I said, that vote left transfer, you know, if that kicks in as well, then we have a real chance.
Yeah, I think there is a chance. I also think the message has gotten through already. I mean, he's dropped from 75% approval, and he's now down to even money in the polls. That's a hell of a drop for a seat that you would call.
Sorry, can I say something? A few months ago, the day Owen Murphy gave up his seat, I remember tweeting, really, and it was a really shitty thing to do, but I said, if they run a wheelie bin with a sticker on it saying Fine Gael and call it Leinstertainment, O'Flaherty, it'll get elected. But unfortunately, their campaign has been so bad that it's actually been, and it has. And James, you're ducking me now. You said twice you were coming on the pod, and now you're ducking me. So if you're listening to this, you have the details. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
And I don't bite. I don't bite.
Sorry, Martin.
Lynn, last words. How are you feeling about the campaign? Are you invigorated? You're going to just fight it right to the end?
Oh, that's it. It's going to be short. So that's always great. Do you know what I mean? You just have to build the momentum. I think certainly because of COVID, Sinn Féin activists are just gagging to get out. People texting me from all over the country going, can we come up and help? Because we're all desperate to get out and start campaigning and meet people and talk to people. So there's huge energy in the campaign, which is great because that then kind of motivates you to, I suppose, do your best because there's a lot of pressure on a candidate in a by-election. There's nowhere to hide. So I'm really enthusiastic and energized by it, but not under any illusions of the mountain that we're expecting me to climb. But it's all good.
Yeah, you know, it is a challenge. There's no question it's a challenge. And it is a Fine Gael heartland. But look, best of luck with it. And we mean that, and we mean that across the left. And it is important that people think that way. It helped a lot in the general where we saw seats that didn't even look viable after a first or second count came back late in the day.
It was actually a really amazing thing to watch, Tony, to watch those last seats where they would usually have tipped over to Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, tipping back to the left. And I think we can develop beyond vote left, transfer left. We can go for AB, FFG. And I think that'll work too. That's anybody but Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. So
I think the general public are already ahead of us on that. There is again, here's my skepticism towards Sinn Féin. I don't think Sinn Féin are actually the public's choice. I think they're the recipient of the thing that we don't want the other two anymore as well. There's an element of that. And then your mettle will be tested if you get the reins of power. But Lynn Boylan, we do wish you all the best and all the best in the campaign and in whatever else happens afterwards. And thanks for talking to us again.
Thanks a million.
Thanks, folks. We will be back. We have the Lord Mayor of Belfast, Kate Nicol, tomorrow morning. So we're back covering that tomorrow morning. So that should be interesting. And we will talk to you all very, very soon.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.